It's the Politics Hour. I'm not Kojo Namdi. I'm Mark Fisher from The Washington Post. Sitting in for Kojo, Tom Sherwood is here. He's our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom, I am given to understand that the Nats won the World Series.
I heard something happened. I was going to check the New York Times to see what happened, since they're so good about covering our city. It was a terrific time. I got to go to all the playoff games, and I was watching the games. It was terrific.
And we'll be talking momentarily with former Mayor Anthony Williams about the Nats and them coming to town in the first place. But there's all this talk always about how world championships paper over our partisan divide. Is that true?
I don't think anything's papered over these days with social media. I do think that the Nats have taken the place of the Washington football team that was often seen as a unifying aspect of this region. And I think because of the team's horrible record, because of its criticized name, I think that they have faded. And the Nats are stepping in for this entire region. The Washington Business Journal did a very long story online. I read one of the longest stories I've ever read in the Business Journal about what it's meant for the entire region. It's not just the District of Columbia. It's the entire region.
Absolutely. We'll be talking later this hour with Clarence Lamb, a Democrat Maryland state senator who is representing Baltimore and Howard counties. We'll also have here in studio Charles Allen, the Democratic D.C. council member representing Ward 6. But first, we're going to talk to the former mayor of the District of Columbia, Anthony Williams, a mayor from 1999 to 2007. He is chief executive of the Federal City Council, and more germane to our discussion today, he's the mayor who can lay claim to having brought a baseball team back to Washington. Mayor, welcome.
Hey, happy to be with you. Thank you, Mark.
So the team that you...
And I say hi to my councilman. I live in Ward 6, so hi to Councilman Allen.
Hello, good. Mr. Mayor.
Hey, what about me?
Hey, how are you? Good.
How about hello to Sherwood?
Yeah, Tom.
There's also that. So the team that you fought so hard to bring to the district has now won the World Series. This is the Holy Grail. Tell me you saw this coming when you were first talking to Major League Baseball about bringing a team here.
No, I didn't. I mean, we thought it was important to have a team. We thought it was a great investment for the district, both for civic spirit, the economic benefits from the team, that we would be importing revenue from outside the city by bringing a fan base to D.C., all those things. I really thought that we would have a championship caliber team when the Lerners bought the team and they made the decisions they made. Now, how soon we would be in a World Series, like a lot of people, I was sometimes often skeptical, but it's fantastic. It's, you know, it's great.
You know, you were, I wrote my city paper story that you were a lifelong, long-time St. Louis Cardinals fan, and of course the Nats swept the Cardinals to get to the World Series. Any mixed emotions there? Any lingering support for St. Louis that you would dare to admit?
You know, to say, you know, old man Bush, St. Louis built a dynasty. They're a great team, but they can't hog all the championships. So I didn't feel that bad for St. Louis, no. But, you know, I've always loved that team. But
talk about
the Nats now, man. Everybody's got to have one team. You got to make a choice. And the Nats, I love the Nats. They're great. I'm not just, you know, hey, look, I'm a season ticket holder. I go to every game I can go to, so I think I can say that with conviction and with no sign of embarrassment.
So take us back to 2004 and the bitter battle over stadium funding. This was the threshold question that would determine whether baseball would come back to Washington after 33 years in the wilderness. Now you can tell us, did you at any point in that bitter battle believe that the deal was dead?
Yeah, there were signs that I thought the deal was, I don't know whether it was on life support, but I knew that felt the deal was in trouble. Jerry Reinsdorf invited him to the concert chamber.
The owner of the Chicago White Sox.
Owner of the Chicago White Sox, representing Major League Baseball, getting a dressing down from some of the council members. I thought, oh my God, this is going sideways. This isn't going in the right direction. Now, I will say that Councilman Allen's great predecessor, Sharon Ambrose, was always a supporter, so... No, she wasn't one of them. But, yeah, there were some council members who really felt that there was an either-or. We were going to do the stadium, and rob our schools and our other human services of support, or we do the right thing by people and deny all these oligarchs, you know, this kind of like a pleasure trip. I think clearly, as it turned out, we had the resources both to do the investment in sports and entertainment, which has paid off. And as I was saying to someone earlier, shortly after we did the stadium, we embarked on a magnificent, and I totally support it, school modernization plan. It's not like that money just turned up. We always had that money available. We just didn't make a good enough case to people that those funds were already in place to do school modernization.
Mr. Mayor, you've said that to a number of groups, that without the money of development, you can't have the money for the social service needs and education needs. You know, there's still a continuum.
Right, I'm criticized by people for gentrification and robbing services for people in need. But if you look at budgets for all of our human service agencies, including starting the move to now get them all out of receivership, I'm just saying it started during my time. So, yes, these funds went to places where they were needed. It, you know, we went out there, we got the field ready, we planted the crops, we harvested the crops, and people were better off, to use a farm analogy.
Well, so apt for baseball, yeah.
Tony Williams. Yeah.
Mr. Mayor, let me ask you, knowing that, you know, there's very controversial that the city paid, initially was going to spend $400 million.
Sir, go ahead, yeah. Okay. I had to turn my tractor off. Go ahead. Okay.
I know you're at some family event. Initially, it was going to be about a $400 million stadium, but with all the work and everything, it was closer to $800 million. You know, Councilmember Jack Evans has said that the Washington football team ought to come back and build its own stadium there. Under what conditions would you want to see that team rebuild at RFK? What would be the city's investment in your view? Would it be worth it? And a council member here has been opposed to having a football team come back. But what would you say, would you want this? You tried in 1999, you said you wanted to bring the Skins back to D.C. What would you do to make that happen?
I think now there would be a number of different things. Obviously, the name is in contention. That has to be worked out. Another, you've got to look at the economics and satisfy, as we did, the council that the economics make sense. That's the burden that, yeah, has to be borne by the proponents. And undeniably, it's harder when instead of talking about 80 or so home games, you're talking about 8.
So, Mayor Williams, the Washington Post was reporting this morning that the Nationals are going to the White House on Monday to meet with President Trump. There have been about 20 sports championships since Trump took office. About 10 of those teams have declined to go to the White House or have been disinvited when it turned out that some players didn't want to be seen with the president. The Red Sox went, but a number of their players refused. The Astros went, but some of their stars skipped the meeting. The same thing with the Capitals. What would you advise the Nationals to do in this instance?
I think that the Nationals who are going to the White House are going there because they've received an invitation from the president, and I respect that. But I respect players who decide they don't want to go.
Would you go?
That's a boring answer, but that's how I feel, you know.
Would you go?
I'm not a player, so I can't say.
Well, you know, the learners, you mentioned the learners and what they've done. They did not. Yeah. President Trump came on Sunday night, and the president was booed, but the learners did invite him. Major League Baseball invited him. The learners chose not to get involved with all that and did not invite him.
I mean, I don't want, you know, look, I'm here to talk about the Nationals, not talk about, I just think that what we talk about normally, clearly norms have been broken now, so. I mean, back in the day, people wouldn't have, I mean, people always boo politicians. It's hard to sort that out from booing this politician, which clearly is a difference.
You're going to miss the parade tomorrow.
Well,
yeah, but I'm going to, if somebody has got a, if somebody's got a tape of it just to be able to see a World Series parade in D.C., imagine that.
Well,
streaming on NBC4.
We'll have to imagine Mayor Anthony Williams at the parade when we're there to cheer on the Nats. Mayor Williams, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Yeah. Go Nats.
Okay. We happen to have right here in studio with us, with Tom Sherwood from our resident analyst, we have Charles Allen, the Ward 6 representative on the D.C. Council. Home of the Nationals
and
ballpark.
The Nationals.
And so what impact has that stadium made on your ward? I mean, obviously, this was an extremely divisive issue for the council back when this decision was made. You weren't there at the time, but you've had to deal with the aftermath. What have been the up and down sides of that?
Well, I mean, the ballpark itself, you know, the former mayor, I think, aptly talked about the difference when we talk about different stadiums. I mean, the Nats ballpark is used 100 times a year between baseball games and events. It's active all the time. And what we've seen is because of that level of activity, you have businesses that go up, you have residents that go up, and it's been a great catalyst. I'd also argue, though, the investments the city made in, for example, Yards Park and some of the great public parks along the Anacostia River have been just as catalytic, which have been phenomenal and have just created this active, vibrant space. When we talk about NFL Stadium, they get used 8 days a year. It is just not even remotely close to the same thing. And you dedicate massive amounts of space for parking lots. So it just doesn't make sense. They're apples and oranges. I do agree with the mayor, though. This is a time to talk about the Nats, to help celebrate that and the accomplishments there, rather than a conversation around that football team.
Councilmember Allen, after decades of steady decline in violent crime around the city, there's now concern that the numbers have been creeping up again and that the streets are not as safe as they'd been in recent years. You serve as chair of the Council Committee on the Judiciary and Public Safety. So what steps are you taking to address this issue of gun violence in particular?
Yeah, you know, I've had conversations with folks all over the city, not just in Ward 6, but really across the entire city. And while we certainly have some metrics that are headed in the right direction, where we're seeing crime decrease, the level of gun violence has been unacceptable. And that's been a trend of the last couple of years. And I think a lot of us are trying to pull in the same direction to change that. We've done a lot of things on the legislative side. We have created new consequences. For example, we're seeing on the scene where you'll have more shell casings, we're seeing higher capacity guns being used. And so we've increased consequences, criminal consequences there. But we've also tried to invest heavily in the violence prevention and violence intervention work. We've stood up in the last year an Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement. They're about a year and a half old, and we just tripled the funding going into those efforts. That's just taking effect at the beginning of October. Part of my job is to make sure we are focused on expanding that as much as we can. We're talking about the type of hard work, the relationship building, the credibility to be able to intervene to either break a cycle of violence or to prevent it in the first place. And that's an incredibly important part of what we've got to do. There's a lot of folks that are focused on this, and I am as well. That's going to be a significant part of our solution to turning around the gun violence we're seeing, and will ultimately, it's going to be part of what helps save lives.
Everyone says that, you know, just having police on the street is not enough. You have to have the social, address the social issues about crime and gun control laws. But do we have enough police officers? Is it properly, are we hiring enough and training enough police officers these days? For a long while there, we were 300 or 400 below the authorized strength. Where are we?
Well, I get the monthly report on what our force numbers look like. I'm comfortable with where we are. We've had what's called a retirement bubble, essentially working its way through the force. Just this last spring, one of the things I did is extended the senior police officer program, which helps keep some of our talented officers on the force. But we already have more police officers per capita than almost every other city. And that's not including even some of the federal law enforcement. So I'm comfortable with where we are in terms of our police force numbers. We've really stabilized the attrition that we had seen from retirements and resignations. And so I feel good with where we are there. What we'll see frequently is both an expectation from some in the community, not all, but some, that they want to see more police officers. That makes them feel more safe. But I represent everybody, and I also have communities that talk about how that makes them feel less safe. That says we have a lot of work to do to help continue to build the trust and the relationship between officers and community policing. But if we only look at this from a law enforcement perspective, we are missing a lot of it. We're only waiting till after the crime takes place, after someone has been injured or hurt. We've got to get in front of it. And that's back where this violence prevention intervention work is so important. And we are not investing yet enough in that. We've got to continue doing more to grow that and make that a huge priority.
We have one of your constituents is on the line and wants to ask you about juvenile crime. Christian, you're on the air.
Hello, Councilman Allen. My name's Christian. I've been in your ward for Ward 6 for more than a decade. And I was calling about recent juvenile crime. The D.C. government, when I've interacted with them in general, I'm always told what they can't do to help, or they throw chaff in the air to confuse the issue. And I've emailed the D.C. government about this, and you were on the email recently where I had my nanny with a kid that was 1 year old and another that is 21 months old was cased by three Eastern High students in their uniforms. And luckily, they didn't go after her. They unfortunately assaulted a man a block away, took his bag, and ran off. The police were called. The reason I'm bringing this up with you is that the response to this and the emails from the government agencies I sent the emails to have been, one, either telling me what they can't do, or two, telling me that lots of people wear Eastern High garb, even though this crime took two blocks from the high school.
Okay, let's hear from council member.
Well, I'm trying to make sure I understood what Christian's question was going to be, but in terms of largely when we talk about juvenile crime, I've been in conversation with both the principal at Eastern. I've had conversations with the attorney general, that's the office that prosecutes most of our juvenile crime. There's going to be an unsatisfactory answer frequently when we're talking about juvenile crime because we are not able to, as a government, to discuss and talk about the specifics of any case when it involves a juvenile. That said, part of what we're trying to do is work hard on the juvenile space to have, for example, the programs at the Attorney General's office that works to help those young people both have accountability, but also to help redirect. We have investments in our restorative justice project, for example, where we bring the victim of a crime from that that juvenile interaction as well as a juvenile. We're seeing really great results from that when we actually use that restorative justice model, and it has greatly reduced recidivism from those young people. That's, you know, not knowing the specifics of the case that Christian's bringing up here, those are some of the efforts that we're taking, but it also speaks to why, you know, violence doesn't just come out of nowhere. When we're talking about a young person, we're talking about economic opportunity, educational opportunity. We've got a lot more that we have to do holistically.
When we come back after a short break, we will continue with Charles Allen and talk about the crime situation in the city, hate crime prosecutions in the district being at their lowest point, and we'll also talk about sex work and the possible decriminalization of that. I'm Mark Fisher from The Washington Post, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. We'll be back after this. Welcome back. I'm Mark Fisher, sitting in for Kojo Namdi, and we are talking with the Ward 6 representative on the D.C. Council, Charles Allen, as well as with our resident analyst, Mr. Tom Sherwood. Yeah.
Let's go back to that, wrap up that issue about crime, because the politics of it is that people can start feeling unsafe with incidences in their neighborhoods. When in long-term solutions about better social justice and better support is one thing. But what do you say, even in a city where most of crime rates are down, homicides are significantly up, but in general, crime rates are down. But what do you say to reassure people that you and this government have their backs when it comes to being safe in their neighborhoods? Yeah.
Well, this is where I hate using stats, frankly, because I can show people all the stats in the world.
It's emotion.
If you have experienced crime, a neighbor, a family member,
heard about it,
then crime just went up for you.
And what do you say for people who are afraid maybe to walk to the nearby grocery or to go to the library because they are just fearful? They've heard about a juvenile crime in their neighborhood. They don't feel safe on the streets.
I think it's really important. You never paper over what someone is experiencing in their own neighborhood. Part of what we try to do, though, is make sure that we are talking about but also demonstrating the different actions we're taking. So, for example, the council, last year, I worked through the council to put in a red flag law, which in theory, I could talk about red flag law all day long. But when it comes to action, it's about getting an illegal gun out of someone's hand before they do harm to themselves or to others. And we need to be able to help use these tools to help demonstrate to the community how the things that we do are actually translating into improvement in public safety. That, to me, is part of what is a challenge for any elected official, but also for government in general, is to make sure that we're translating these different things. When we make investments in the Office of Neighborhood Safety Engagement, I've worked to have make sure our violence prevention and violence interrupters are actually in the community at meetings, for example. I want the community to understand What does that look like? What does a violence interrupter look like? We've had meetings, for example, where we've had great folks that are returning citizens that are now doing the hard work of, and they have credibility to help stop further violence. Helene Flowers, Kareem McCraney, in the community, and having people see them and understand this is what that looks like.
Another area where there may be a disconnect between the perception of crime and the numbers is hate crimes, where there's been considerable talk around town about the hate crime prosecutions in the district being at their lowest point in a decade. And for some folks, that's a sign that there's insufficient prosecution. For others, it's a sign that maybe fewer hate crimes. What do you think the reality is, and why do you think those prosecutions have become a relative rarity?
Yeah, well, I would say that there's not a question about the number of hate crimes. So the reports of hate crimes have actually gone up dramatically. And so the last couple of years, and there's probably no way to avoid the connection that we see with the current occupant of the White House, giving so much space and credence to people to embrace that hate and to act on it. But we have seen hate crimes against our neighbors go up dramatically. And then we have at the same time seen the prosecution using our hate crimes law go to record lows. That to me, it does not speak to the values of our city, but it also sends an incredibly chilling message to our LGBTQ neighbors, to communities of color, that we are not using the tools that we have. And so we held a hearing just a couple of weeks ago where we were trying to understand what's going on. The U.S. Attorney's Office, which is the federal prosecutor appointed via the federal government, and they prosecute our local crimes, the only place in the country where that happens, they didn't show up. It would have been a great opportunity to have a conversation, though, to understand why is it that we're seeing this, because the lack of showing up is, it's not just insulting to the council or to me, it's insulting to the whole city. It's insulting to the ability to have our LGBTQ neighbors know that we're taking this seriously.
I agree with you that it is insulting for the U.S. Attorney, Jessie Liu, not to come herself or not to send someone. But she did put out a statement that said that while the police have made a significant number of arrests, they haven't presented them to the prosecution office for prosecution. She gave the numbers, but she says there are hundreds of arrests for hate crimes, but they don't actually make it to the U.S. Attorney's Office for them to be prosecuted. Is there a dropping of the ball by the police department?
Wouldn't that have been a great conversation to have at a hearing? We had MPD there, and
she said, just
the
for
arrests
example,
are being made. The charging decisions are made from the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Well, she said, of the 204 potentially bias-related incidents flagged by police department, in 2018, only 59 were prosecuted, which suggests that the police were not forwarding the information. And this is a long time fight between the prosecutors and the police about what information.
No, that's not what that says.
And about 59 resulted in arrests that were presented to the office for prosecution.
Presented for prosecution. Then look at the next number, which is how many were actually prosecuted, which is about 3. So basically what they're saying is that we went from having 99% of them not prosecuted to 95% of them not prosecuted. That's not a good number, and it says a lot to our city.
You're also you're having a disagreement with the U.S. Attorney's Office over changing the sentencing of people who are convicted as the youth, reducing their sentencing. The U.S. Attorney's Office went extraordinary lengths to oppose it. Saying you were releasing murderers and rapists and all kinds of things. Is there any hope? I mean, you actually sat down with Jessie Liu. I know the mayor has to talk about the gun prosecutions, but have you, in fact, sat down with the prosecutor, Jessie Liu, and said, let's work together and not just complain to each other?
Yeah, we sit down once a month with the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. We've had face-to-face meetings. The U.S. Attorney's Office has not brought up the issues that you're talking about. So they're not being elevated to the people.
Well, they brought them up to the public. They invited the ANC commissioners in and big meetings.
The Second Look Act you're talking about, that was another hearing that the attorney's office didn't come to. I'll say another one, which is we're looking at how do we get illegal guns off our streets, gun trafficking. We held an entire hearing focused on that, on illegal guns that are on our streets. Over 2,000 illegal guns are taken off our streets by MPD.
So
we don't see prosecutions. Again, didn't show up to the hearing. We need partners that come to the table to have these tough conversations, because that's how we move towards solution.
As part of that conversation about hate crimes, you are proposing something called the Panic Defense Prohibition Act. What is panic defense, and how would this help increase the government's ability to hold people accountable?
Currently, there is a defense that exists where someone's able to essentially say that they acted in that violent way in a defense to all of a sudden discovering that someone was gay, that there was this this ability to all of a sudden, because of who that person is, all of a sudden becomes their own defense. We heard testimony from Mark Rodifer, for example, who was assaulted, and as they were trying to prosecute that, essentially the argument boiled down to making up a story about how, well, because this person was gay, therefore I shouldn't be held
to account. And that's considered a legitimate legal defense?
It has been.
Around the country,
absolutely,
yes,
around the country. So jurisdictions are looking at how we do that, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It also,
except people are triggered by the mere fact that somebody right. is a gay person and they feel threatened, and then they act out or something. I mean, it's really so ridiculous. I can't believe we're talking about it.
It's one of these things where it seems like it's maybe an artifact that's built into law. It's but it's not just an artifact. It's a bias that is built into the law. And so we're looking at how we make that change. Because that's not a defense that you should be able to make, that all of a sudden I am no longer accountable because someone is just who they are. That's something we're going to be changing.
Let's hear from Carlos in the district. Carlos, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Councilmember Allen, for your leadership on the Judiciary Committee. I was wanting to find out where you saw the bill on the decriminalization of sex work heading, especially after the contentious hearing. And also wanted to find out when you think it might be coming up on the docket, the bill on mandatory reporting. The last hearing was in July, and I'm not aware of anything further happening. And I also wanted to give kudos to Kevin Whitfield on your staff, who's been nothing but helpful and being responsive and informing me of what's going on with the mandatory reporting bill.
Well, I appreciate the shout out for my staff. I'm very proud of the team that we've built. If he's not listening right now, I'll make sure he gets that. In terms of the decriminalization effort around sex work, we held a hearing about 2 weeks or so ago. One of the things that I think was very clear that we heard from a lot of people was that further criminalizing sex work itself is nothing but just damaging. What it does is it creates more barriers, more contacts of the criminal justice system. And for individuals that are trying to leave sex work, just creates a criminal history that becomes overwhelming in terms of being the ability to have further employment or housing or education. And where there was incredibly sharp division was on how and what that path looks like to move forward. So the legislation had been introduced by Councilmember Grasso and others. I think it was a very appropriate thing to have a public discussion and a hearing. I think there were incredibly sharp divisions about what that path forward looks like. I don't see consensus
right now. You
have some
of those thoughts yourself about how
absolutely.
It would
be
done.
The concern,
it's not just people. You have concerns.
Yeah,
about
the concerns
it.
That I have and that others have is if you completely decriminalize sex work, what you end up doing is, what you risk doing is, are we making it more difficult, for example, to be able to hold sex traffickers accountable? We already see prosecutions for sex trafficking very low, even though we know that there is a lot of sex trafficking. To have legalization essentially of pimping or of brothels, that was one of the concerns that was cited.
We would be unique in the nation, even in Nevada, there's very limited.
But I do think what's important is that there was a lot of support for understanding the negative consequences of over-criminalizing the sex work itself. So the path forward right now, I don't think the votes are there on the council. I don't think they're in committee. There seems to be a lot of contention. There's not consensus on what that path forward looks like.
But it
was a very important conversation to have and to give a lot of voice to a community that is already very marginalized. And we're trying to think through ways to make sure that we're making sure that sex workers themselves are safe and that we don't further marginalize a marginalized community.
This bill won't be moved in this year, probably.
As of right now, no.
We'll have to leave it there. Charles Allen, the Ward 6 representative on the District Council, thanks so very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom,
I have mayoral questions.
Yeah, well.
Next time.
But Tom Sherwood, one of the things that we have coming up on the other side of the Potomac River, the elections on Tuesday in Virginia will determine which party controls both houses in Richmond. It was an interesting dichotomy this week where we saw the New York Times run a story reporting on how Republicans running in suburban Virginia districts have taken a turn toward the moderate. They're disguising some of their conservative votes and positions, talking about their support for anti-discrimination legislation, their efforts to address gun violence, to expand Medicaid. And yet the same day, the Washington Post ran the opposite story, saying that although many Republicans in swing districts did moderate their messages and downplay their Republicanism, a number of them have now, in the last days before the election, veered right again, and they are trying to turn out GOP voters by casting Democrats as extremists, calling them socialists, doubling down on their opposition to abortion and to immigration. What's going on there, and who will that tactic work?
Well, both are true. You wrote a great story, incidentally, if I can promote what you wrote about Tim Hugo's race in suburban Northern Virginia, the last standing Republican, who's worth a read for people to understand what's happening in Northern Virginia. But the fact is, as you get days before an election, the mailers get tougher, the phone calls get meaner. The Republicans, all the reporting we've done is WAMU has been doing special reports on Wednesdays for the last month on the elections. It looks like because of the unpopularity of President Trump, because of the massacre in Virginia Beach, because of the fight over guns in general, and it looks like the Republicans are facing a very tough day on Tuesday, November the 5th. And so some of the Republicans in more rural or exurbs right outside the suburbs are turning to aggressive, very conservative campaigns because of the gunfight. You know, Beto O'Rourke saying that we're coming for your guns was a tremendous boost for conservative Republicans. But I think overall the demographics of Virginia are changing, and you'll see it Tuesday night with suburban women who don't like President Trump, who are concerned about their families and panic drills in schools, that something should be done about guns. Republicans, you know, junked that special session back on June or July the 9th after 90 minutes and did nothing about guns. I think you'll see people are going to respond on Tuesday.
The race that I wrote about today, Dan Helmer against Tim Hugo, the longtime delegate from House District 40 in Fairfax and Prince William counties. Tim Hugo is literally the last Republican in Northern Virginia. Does that make a difference? Should people care that there be some voice in the party that, at least for the moment, rules Virginia from the region of Northern Virginia?
Well, the Republican Party is you know, they are supporting President Trump on this. But as you point out in the story, Hugo is a "I'll fix your pothole" kind of politician. He's not trying to play any significant issues. He says, "I'm a local politician." I'm not sure state senators or state delegates and senators have to fix potholes, but he's trying to say, "Look, I'm not an ideologue here. I'm trying to help my community. Don't vote me out because of this distrust and irritation on the Democratic Party side." It's an uphill battle for him.
When we come back after a short break, we'll be joined by Clarence Lamb, Maryland state senator representing Baltimore and Howard counties, as the Politics Hour continues. Welcome back. I'm Mark Fisher of The Washington Post, sitting in for Kojo and talking with Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. And Tom, the district is trying to make it possible for more workforce class people to stay in the city and continue to be firefighters and police officers. And in this case, teachers, where public school teachers are going to get help paying for a home. It's an initiative that is partly public, partly private. It involves a company in San Francisco that's going to help teachers pay for half of their down payment, up to a maximum of $120,000 toward a house. In exchange for that help, however, the company will get 25% of any increase in the home value when the teacher then sells that property. So there's some controversy around whether this is really helpful to the teachers or to that company in San Francisco.
Well, it might be helpful to individual teachers here and there. A similar program the mayor has announced previously has helped police officers. The fact is, the Manhattanization of the District of Columbia has made it unaffordable for middle-income people. If you don't have some type of government assistance or you're not paid well, you have a hard time finding places to either buy or rent in the city. So this is another effort at addressing a very large problem. The mayor is, you know, says we need 36,000 more units of housing by 2025. 16,000 of them need to be affordable. Housing is a crisis across the country, particularly in the urban areas, and we haven't yet found the right ways to address it, but these are some of the ways that we're trying.
And, of course, it's becoming an increasing problem in some of the suburban areas, and we'll be talking about that a little later with Clarence Lamb. Senator Lamb, welcome to the program. Senator is a state senator representing Baltimore and Howard counties. He's a Democrat, and you are representing an area that was part of Representative Elijah Cummings' district. And the scene at the funeral for Representative Cummings was a powerful reminder of his influence and stature. And what did he mean to the people you represent?
He was a tremendous representative to the folks in my district, and really someone whose moral compass was always true, someone who stood up for justice, but always with the people, who recalled where he came from and was really committed to justice and the law. And we will miss him dearly in having his voice representing us in Capitol Hill.
He represented your area. Your Senate district was in his congressional district.
A good chunk of my Senate district.
So are you running for the are you add your name to the telephone book?
I am not running
for
Congress.
Are you supporting anyone to replace him?
I think it's
you've got state senators looking, delegates are looking. Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, his widow, and the state party chairman. Go out on a limb here. Who are you supporting? This is the politics hour.
It is early. There are a lot of good folks that will come out.
They have to get in by November 20th. That's 19 days.
That's true. There's still a lot of time for people to come out.
I know the calendar.
For that. And so, you know, I'm sure there will be a lot of good candidates coming out.
Will you endorse someone or will you just stay out of it since you're not running?
I am not certain yet. I'd like to know who is running. And I am focused, though, on serving the constituents of District 12.
Is Maya Cummings, Rocky Moore Cummings, doing a good job as state party chair?
She is doing a very good job as the state party chair. She is certainly making her way around the state and has made her way around the state, championing many different areas and districts and causes. And so we really are blessed to have her as our state party chair.
Tom would, of course, spend the rest of the hour running you through all the possible candidates to try to suss out where you really are on this. But in the meantime, the longest-serving speaker in the history of Maryland, Mike Bush, passed away in the spring, and now Mike Miller, who is battling cancer, is stepping down from the Senate presidency. That's a lot of change for the legislature that you're a part of. What does the era of the end of the era of the two Mikes mean for Maryland and particularly for the people you represent?
It's really a changing of the guard here. This is a generational change that we have never seen, probably in the likes of the state legislature, where you have two new presiding officers coming into the House of Delegates and also a new Senate president coming into the Senate of Maryland. I think I think a lot of us have a lot of hope that with new folks coming in, with new attention being given to issues and fresh focuses and perspectives being brought into the caucus, I think we are really looking forward to a productive legislative session. But as with any new body, when you look through the Tuckman's group of layers of group development of storming, forming, and norming, I think we're going to see that all occur very quickly. But I know and have a lot of confidence in both of our presiding officers. I've known them both personally for years, and I know they will be great leaders for both bodies.
That's the big news is that the suburban Washington area of Maryland has been in charge of state assembly for a couple of decades, several decades. Now all the power has shifted to Baltimore and Baltimore City.
Adrian Jones.
I started to say Washington because it's somebody I know. She's the speaker. She's from Baltimore County. Bill Ferguson. Tell us about Bill Ferguson. 36 years old from Baltimore County. He wipes away all the opposition, and he's the Democratic caucus has said he'll be the next president of the Senate, and you'll vote him in January. What is it about him? What should people in the suburban Maryland area know about Bill Ferguson?
So I think it's important to keep in mind that Senator Ferguson was actually born in Montgomery County. He was born and raised there.
And he's new to the Senate, though, just since like 2010 or 2011. He hasn't been there for a while.
That's correct, yes.
He's a newbie.
He's one of the new generation of leaders coming into the Senate of Maryland.
And so are you.
And so am I. And you know, even when I came in, there were 17 new senators that came in earlier this year, folks who were elected last year.
There are 47, right, total?
There are 47. So right, 17 total. Out of 47 are new within the past year. But I think that's where we're seeing new perspectives, fresh leadership come through, new energy and enthusiasm for folks to be able to expand our caucus and continue to build bridges with our colleagues. I think there's a lot of issues that we need to tackle that are really difficult coming up ahead, particularly when it comes to education and the Kerwin Commission.
I want to mention the Kerwin Commission. The governor has denounced it as a money grab, or other words he's used. But the new president of the Senate, Bill Ferguson, is a former Teach for America teacher, considered liberal. And if the governor has thought he's had trouble with the legislature before, it looks to me, if he doesn't bend a little, he's going to have a great deal more trouble.
I think there's going to be a lot to see, and I know that Senator Ferguson will be a champion for education. He's made that a strong priority of his. And so when it comes to Kerwin, the commission's recommendations on how we can elevate and bring up and improve our public school system, Senator Ferguson will be a champion for that. And I know Speaker Jones will be too. And so, you know, I think that's an issue where there is no daylight between the two bodies. I think it will be interesting to see with new presiding officers how that relationship will work with the governor. I know that Senator Ferguson is not one who's afraid to go toe-to-toe when he believes in a cause, and I think Kerwin will be one of those.
We are talking with Senator Clarence Lamb, a Democrat from Baltimore and Howard counties. And Senator, one of the big headlines out of Maryland in recent months has been the school redistricting proposal in Howard County. What exactly is being proposed and why is it so controversial?
You have 1 minute.
1 minute. Let me try to capture that. So school redistricting is basically reassignments of particular neighborhoods within communities to specific schools, right? And so it is obviously very controversial because neighborhoods are very used to sending their children to specific schools.
People buy houses with certain assumptions.
I think people buy with certain assumptions. Sometimes these are misconceptions, but, you know.
Misconceptions? You I think people buy
misconceptions about the nature of the school.
Misconceptions that the schools that they are assigned to when they buy that house will never change, right? And that's why I have a piece of legislation that I've introduced to make sure that that is made clear to people at their time of closing. When they buy that home, they realize that that home and any students coming from it could be reassigned to any school at any point in time, depending on the Board of Education.
But why shouldn't people be able to rely on the idea that I'm buying into a particular school district? Why shouldn't that be an assumption
of motivation?
Exactly.
Right. So we have a school system. We have Howard County Public School System here. And what people are buying into is into a school system, and all of our schools are great. I would put any of our schools within Howard County up against any school and recognize that it would do phenomenally well. And so, you know, I think the concern here is really one of addressing needs within the system, and that includes capacity imbalances. Sometimes you have neighborhoods being built in areas where schools are already full. And what you need to do is be able to reassign students to schools that have capacity. I have a school in my Howard High School in my district is at almost 140% capacity, and yet we have schools within the Howard County Public School System, high schools, that are at just about 80% capacity. If we don't rebalance some of those seats, we're going to have permanently crowded schools, and that's not fair.
But crowding is not the only issue behind redistricting. And while it's certainly nice to say that we love all of our schools in any given system, every parent is glued to those sites that show the test scores and the various metrics that purportedly show whether one school is better than another, however you want to define that. So obviously you understand that there's a lot of people have been up in arms, a lot of people have been coming out to public meetings saying that they moved to specific neighborhoods because they were zoned for certain schools. And, you know, this takes us back to the busing debates of the 1970s and 80s. Obviously, there are race and class issues involved here. If you were to level with the people who are opposed to this, it's not just about crowding, right?
I think it's, from the state's perspective, it's mostly about crowding. We as a state provide probably about 40% of the funding required for school capital construction dollars here in Howard County. And we have a responsibility then to make sure that those seats are used most efficiently. We cannot build our way out of the issues that we have in the county. We cannot just constantly build more schools because schools are overcrowded. We have to use the seats that we have most efficiently. And that means potentially reassigning students to different schools based on capacity needs. Now, the school system, the Board of Education, has the actual responsibility of drawing the lines and assigning specific polygons to specific schools. They've had hours and hours of hearings. They've extended hearings.
They've got five more work sessions to work through
how they're going to redraw some of these lines, but they've had hours and hours of hearings to try to gather input from the community, and they've done a phenomenal job in that. And what they're doing now is trying to pull all of that together to make the actual hard decisions as to where school assignments will go.
On the state delegation level, just to be clear, do not draw those lines.
Right,
you don't draw the lines, but and this is also not something we're thinking about looking into later. This is something they're going to do on November 21st, I think.
November 22nd, I believe.
22nd, right, yes. Before Thanksgiving.
Right. Yeah.
And the debate has gotten quite ugly, and there have been even overtly racist statements made, letters to county officials about black families and destroying school systems. I mean, just straight out racist stuff. Has it surprised you how virulent the rhetoric has been?
It is not, because we went through this process 2 years ago in 2017 when the Board of Education also tried to implement a strong redistricting plan. They ended up ratcheting it back because of all the community animosity that came out. And look, I understand for many folks in the community, this is a fraught decision. This is a really difficult decision. It becomes very emotional and contentious, but it is necessary as a school system to have to engage in this process to make sure that we are using our seats most efficiently, because we simply cannot build our way out of the issues that we have.
We have just a minute left, so we'll have to. One last thing is about the Bay Bridge, which is going to remain closed through the Thanksgiving holiday, meaning some very heavy traffic. The governor wants this process to speed up, and the contractors are working around the clock. What's your take on this? Is that the right time to be shutting down the Bay Bridge?
I am concerned about that. I don't think it's the right time to be shutting down the Bay Bridge. You know, there have been a lot of community concerns from both sides of the Bay about the construction that's been undergoing at the Bay Bridge. And so, you know, I think they need to take a closer look at that and make sure that we're not hitting peak times like the Thanksgiving holiday. There's some real concerns there, and there's some real needs for both communities. That's an essential lifeline for so many parts of our state, the Eastern Shore connecting to Central Maryland, whether it's businesses, schools,
You support a new bridge, don't you? Long-term, you support a new bridge yet?
I'm not saying where,
because I know that's a big deal.
I think when you look at the needs of the state, there will be need for additional access points. Now, where that is, I know that's obviously very controversial and up for debate.
And in the few seconds we have left, what is your number one priority for the upcoming legislative session?
My number one priority is making sure that we address education, the Kerwin Commission recommendations, and make sure that we have funding coming back to our counties for school capital construction dollars. We have a lot of needs in our system and counties, and we need to bring dollars back so that they can improve and renovate their schools.
Clarence Lamb is a Democrat representing Baltimore and Howard counties, a Maryland state senator. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Set your clock back Sunday.
That's right. And we've also been joined by our clock reminder, Tom Sherwood, the resident analyst here and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Julie Deppenbrock. Coming Monday, an update on how local immigrants are being affected by the Trump administration's proposed changes to the temporary protected status provision. That's noon on Monday. I'm Mark Fisher from The Washington Post, sitting in for Kodjo. Thanks for joining us.
The Kodjo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, Sydney Grannon, Maura Curry, and Victoria Chamberlain. Our managing producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Natalie Yurov-Lifker. Our intern is Laura Spitalniak. For past shows and more content, visit kodjoshow.org.